For Sounds of Dissent, I'm Amy Grunder. Negotiators from the United States and eight other so-called Pacific Rim countries concluded a round of talks in San Diego this month on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the mammoth mother of all trade agreements you never heard of. That might be because the U.S. public and the Congress are prohibited from participating or even viewing the draft treaty, while over 600 corporate representatives who sit on government advisory boards have privileged access. Much more than a trade agreement, it will tie the hands of legislators in all nine countries, mandating domestic policies on labor, the environment, agriculture, product safety, intellectual property rights, and even government procurement policies, as well as regulations on finance, healthcare, energy, and telecommunications, according to four U.S. senators who wrote a letter to the Obama administration last June. The senators wrote in protest after a draft copy of the agreement was leaked by California Republican Representative Darrell Issa. Joining us today is Lori Wallach, Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch and an expert on international trade policies and trade agreements, including NAFTA, CAFTA, and the World Trade Organization. She works with Congress, scholars, and activists in the United States and abroad on the effects of globalization on jobs, wages, the environment, democracy, and social justice. Thank you for joining us, Lori, and welcome to Sounds of Dissent.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to have you join us. Lori, you had a piece in The Nation late last month calling the Trans-Pacific Partnership NAFTA on steroids. Talk about the scope of this agreement. Why is it so controversial?
Well, it's really misbranded as a trade agreement. The contents of the agreement span over 26 chapters, and only two of those chapters really have to do with trade, in the sense of anything any of us would recognize, i.e. products being sold between countries. The other 24 chapters would impose top-down a set of policies covering all those issues that you've just mentioned and more that we would be required to conform our domestic, state, federal, and local policies and laws to. And if we don't, the United States could get dragged into international tribunals, both by corporations and by other governments, with our tax dollars having to be paid as sanctions if we refuse to change our laws. Now, the
Lori, could you break that out for us a little bit? I'm sorry to jump in here, but they're not quite foreign tribunals, are they? These are arbitration panels set up under the auspices of intergovernmental organizations to which countries consent to appear in, and the country agrees in advance to arbitration, right? And there are three arbitrators, one chosen by each side, etc. And this is, to make things clear for the listener, this is when companies find their rights abrogated in some way when they're investing in our country. Same thing with corporations in other countries. They can bring that government to court. Could you break it out a little bit?
Well, they're two different regimes, but I just want to say one thing about the rules. The rules that are getting imposed are many of the same things, the most 1% or corporate dream agenda that has been rejected repeatedly in open democratic fora. So, for instance, just as a preview, one of the things that's in there in the copyright chapter, in the intellectual property chapter, is a revival of SOPA, the Stop Online Privacy Act, the Anti-Internet Freedom Bill, that even this conservative Congress stopped because it was so over the top, outrageous, criminalizing many of the things we do every day on the internet. Now, how are these crazy corporate rules enforced? There is a system that you just described where foreign investors, both U.S. investors in other countries, but foreign companies here, would have the right to sue the U.S. government, not under our laws or in our courts, but in what I think is accurately a foreign tribunal. The way it works is the World Bank has a set of arbitration rules, and any foreign corporation can declare that their new rights and privileges, if this agreement were to go into effect, were not being met by the sovereign government. They're elevated to the equal status as a whole government to privately enforce what is a public treaty. And the way it works is three private sector lawyers, so none of the normal conflict of interest. The lawyers in this sort of body of experts rotate between suing governments for the corporations and acting as the judges, if you could see me, there would be air quotes around judges, those tribunalists under this agreement would be given the authority. The U.S. would submit itself, as would the other countries, to the jurisdiction of these kangaroo courts, and they would have the authority to demand the payment of our taxpayer dollars out to foreign corporations for what they claim is any violation of their rights, one of which is a right basically for governments not to change the policies in place when they started to invest. And that covers everything from land use and zoning to environmental and toxics policy to mining and gas and oil exploration.
The much vaunted stability of the investment environment.
As well, all kinds of financial regulations, so limits on the size of banks, guarantees of being able to move capital with no restrictions, even if you cause a crisis. So all of these new rights will be privately enforced.
There's a second system. Go ahead.
Which is another set of international foreign tribunals set up in the agreement. And in those tribunals, governments can also sue governments over their not following these rules. And in those tribunals, the penalty is trade sanctions, which means extra penalties on U.S. exports. It plays out basically as an economic penalty so that the domestic law gets changed. That system exists in the WTO. The private enforcement system is not in the WTO. But under our past WTO cases, where these foreign tribunals have ruled against dolphin protection laws and the Clean Air Act regulations and the corporate fuel efficiency, the automobile fuel efficiency standards, the U.S. has always complied and changed the law to avoid the sanctions. So it's a very strong enforcement of very retrograde rules that have nothing to do with trade.
What happened to the World Trade Organization? That was an international body, that intergovernmental body that we heard a lot about over 10 years ago. Why isn't that institution involved in negotiating these agreements?
That organization includes most of the countries in the world, and it is in existence. It has some very bad rules. What the TPP would do is go considerably further. So in all the areas where countries fought back and civil society fought back successfully, everyone heard about WTO, particularly around the Seattle 1999 WTO summit. And the agenda there was to expand the WTO's powers to impose some of these new corporate rights. And enough countries and enough civil society movements around the world said no and continued to say no for the next decade, so that this proposed WTO expansion that was first derailed in Seattle has never happened. It's a citizen victory. We fought that back successfully. So now the same corporate interests and sadly some of the same governments, including the U.S. government, whether under Democrats or Republicans, have been pursuing that same agenda through these other forms of negotiation. And the TPP is the current form of choice. The idea is to lock in these rules, and then the U.S. would never negotiate the terms of an agreement again. So if these backwards, crazy corporate rules are in place, the U.S. would just make any other country that wants to have an agreement with us join those rules. You could sort of call it, you know, the answer for the 1% when Seattle befell them and they couldn't expand the WTO. It's a shell game. It's the same agenda.
Could you say something about the secrecy surrounding these negotiations? It is normal for the government to negotiate these kinds of agreements in secrecy, at least according to the senators who wrote the Obama administration. But they also add that given the extent of this particular treaty, that it's wrong. The unprecedented scope of these negotiations requires more public oversight. What do you have to say about that?
Well, first of all, there certainly has been too much secrecy in the past about trade negotiations. Typically, the texts are kept secret initially until they get far along. But the TPP is of a totally different level of lockdown secrecy. For instance, The last time there was an attempt to do this kind of regional NAFTA on steroids was the Free Trade Area of the Americas. Some folks might remember that, the FTAA. It was a plan pushed by the corporations and the Clinton administration to do NAFTA from Alaska to the tip of Chile. That agreement, after it was in the same position that this one is, which is to say this TPP has been through 3 years of negotiation, there's a draft composite text of all the chapters. When the FTA was in that state, now it had been secret in the beginning years, but after that, the governments released it. In 2001, the full draft text of the entire Free Trade Area of the Americas was published by all of the 30-plus governments involved, so that the public and their congresses and parliaments could review it and debate it. In addition, in the past, so this is dramatic that they're not releasing it. In addition, in the past, every member of the U.S. Congress could go to the Capitol into a secured room and look at any part of a draft trade agreement. They just could bring their staff if their staff had security clearance, but any member could. This time around, the negotiators are denying even, for instance, the chairman. The letter that you were mentioning was led by the chairman of the Senate Trade Subcommittee. The senator who has the official legal jurisdiction over this treaty is being denied the right to see it. This is unprecedented. And then finally, in the past, the process was such that while there was an enormous amount of unacceptable secrecy, there was the possibility of getting all the documents. This time, the negotiators for TPP have made an agreement that for 4 years after either the agreement is signed or it fails, none of the supporting documents will be released. We will just see a text at the very end. We'll never know what the different countries thinking, their offers. None of the documents needed to interpret it will be publicly available for 4 years after it's done or it dies. Those are unprecedented levels of secrecy.
Why,
in a process,
Laurie?
That already was secret.
Why such secrecy around this particular treaty? Is it? I guess it's fairly obvious. It's because of the scope and the likely pushback.
That's right. I mean, you know, we jokingly call this the Dracula strategy. This is something that cannot be taken out of the crypt because the mere inve of sunshine will vaporize it. If we knew what was in there, in so many different areas, sneaking in, undermining of internet freedom, limiting food safety, giving foreign corporations the right to attack our natural resources policies and our financial regulations, limits on service sector regulation, all of these issues that affect us every day, if we knew, this would be an issue that actually the left, the right, and the middle would all be up in arms with, the 99% against the 1%. And perversely, in a moment of candor, the chief U.S. trade negotiator, the United States Trade Representative, Ron Kirk, had a slip of the lip and told Bloomberg News Service in an interview in May, well, it's true we did release the Free Trade Area of the Americas, but, you know, that was a bad idea because once the public saw that, we never could finish it the way we wanted to. So he's basically admitting that they have to keep it secret or they can't do the corporate agenda.
So the countries involved in this particular agreement so far anyway are the United States, of course, Australia, Brunei, Chile, Malaysia, New Zealand, Peru, Singapore, and Vietnam. Now, just to put this in context for folks, maybe a little historical context as well, governments become part of these treaties, or particularly the investment provisions, not just the trade, but the ones governing companies coming in and investing in countries. Governments become part of the treaty because they want the foreign direct investment. And corporations that invest want the treaty because they want protection from expropriation, which happened a lot. There were a lot of nationalizations in the 60s and 70s. Having invested billions of dollars in a project, one could argue that they rightfully want to protect that investment and not just have the government take it over. So these treaties ensure that the governments have to pay. They're allowed to expropriate, but it has to be for, I guess, health or public safety or other public reasons. And then they have to compensate. What's wrong with that?
Well, you're describing what used to be the standard in what were called bilateral investment treaties, and those started in those started in the 50s. And those basically had a rule that was fairly reasonable, the original ones, that said if a government takes your oil refinery or takes your land or whatever, either for a public purpose, they want to put a road there, or they just seize it because they're nationalizing the oil sector, they have to pay you compensation, and it set an arbitral tribunal where you could go to fight over how much. And there were different ways that companies ensured that they weren't going to get rolled. They would have investment insurance. If there was a bilateral investment treaty, they could use that method, et cetera. The difference is that concept has been hijacked and added into these vast so-called trade agreements with a whole set of different rules. So instead of the fair rule of if the government takes your stuff, they pay, there are now a whole array of new rights. So for instance, one of the specific rights, because you mentioned a text leaked and it was posted, the whole agreement has never been seen. One of the chapters that leaked that people can see and also see an analysis of on our website, tradewatch.org, is the investment chapter. So that chapter, we actually know what the text says. And among other things, it says that a foreign investor will be guaranteed a minimum standard of treatment. That has been interpreted. It's a very loose standard, but it's been interpreted to mean security against changes in government policy. So you get new information, there's a change in elections, whatever is the reason you improve a policy, you can get compensation for merely the democratic process deciding, for instance, in the United States, we, after the global financial crisis, are going to improve our financial regulation. Or right now there's a horrible case going on in El Salvador. The government, in a way that treats domestic and foreign mining firms the same, has decided that they will not allow cyanide leach mining of gold without a whole set of environmental and other reviews. They're reviewing it. And it's affecting all the mining firms who are interested in doing that process, domestic or foreign. That is the subject of a case. There have been attacks, for instance, on denials of toxic waste dump permits, where the domestic firm gets denied, but the foreign one next door gets, this is a Mexico NAFTA case, $17 million for having the same thing happen that happened under domestic law. You can't have a toxic waste dump over an aquifer. That was done to a domestic firm. So it's
Lori, where's the expropriation in that?
There isn't any. That's my point. It's not expropriation. That's called minimum standard of guaranteed treatment. That, by the way, Amy, is the language that promotes offshoring. Because the flip of that is, under those rules, a company gets better treatment, better than even what the domestic firms get, but better than they were getting at home, if they leave. So a lot of people say, how is it exactly that NAFTA and these agreements have cost 6 million U.S. manufacturing jobs? It's because under these investor rules, we incentivize leaving. You get these special deals if you leave. The second one, by the way, is called indirect expropriation or regulatory takings. And under that rule, any government action that could undermine the, quote, expected future profits of your investment is something that you can get compensated for. So if you're a U.S. firm and we decide, as we have over the decades, to improve, for instance, reforesting requirements, so that if you get a contract with the government to harvest timber on a piece of land, you have to plant trees so you don't have erosion and pollute streams. You do a change like that, and it undermines the investor's expected future profit. The U.S. firm has to comply with the domestic law, and it's in the public interest. The foreign firm gets compensated by us taxpayers for having to meet the same rule. Has nothing to do with expropriation. And just a few weeks ago, the first case under CAFTA, the Central America Free Trade Agreement, was decided. There's a case where there's just no expropriation. Nothing was seized. Nothing was happened. Nothing formal happened. The government of Guatemala started a process to review. They have a process in their legal system to review a contract over a firm from the U.S. that had gotten the concession to operate their privatized railroad system. And that U.S. firm was not meeting the obligations. They had promised to do certain investments, to get certain lines going, and the firm had not managed its finances, was in dire straits, and was not following its end of the contract. but they were still continuing to get rents from all of the real estate that they owned under the contract without running the railroad. So the government basically said, we have to review this. This is not working out for both parties. The very initiation of the review process, called LACIVO, was deemed to violate the investors' castor rights, and they were just, Guatemala, incredibly poor country, was just ordered to pay what will end up being about $20 million for having a review of a company not meeting its contract obligations. Nothing was taken.
There has been some, I'd like you to say something about the pushback against these agreements, not just from Congress, as we just saw, but first of all, from developing countries. There have been a few countries that have ended their relationship with the ICSID. Of course, they probably still have to go through with the ones that have already been lodged against them. I'm thinking of Bolivia, Ecuador, and now Venezuela. Venezuela's departure was on Wednesday, and the Latin American Herald Tribune reported on Friday, yesterday, that in the last week alone, $1 billion of claims were filed against it. And Chavez, Hugo Chavez, announced, when he announced his departure in January, he said that the ICSID, that is the World Bank body, the International Center for the Settlement of Investment Disputes, the ICSID has ruled 230 times in favor of transnational interests in the 234 cases heard throughout its history.
These are not fair tribunals, and it's important that certain countries are leaving them. The problem is that in TPP, the foreign investor can pick among various different foreign tribunals. So ICSID is just one of the places that every country submits themselves to the jurisdiction of. There are other similar tribunals. So while that's an important one to leave, because that's the one that has been used a lot and is not very fair, obviously, that doesn't fix the problem. The thing we all need to do, basically, is the reverse Dracula strategy. They want to hide the 1%, the negotiators who want this, want to hide the TPP in a crypt so that they get it done, it becomes a reality before any of us know what it means for our day-to-day lives. I mean, you know, just to put this in perspective, the offshoring that could occur under this agreement, given one of the countries involved is Vietnam, which is the low-cost alternative to China.
What do you mean by offshoring, Lori?
Offshoring of jobs and investment. So all those investor rules that I just described that promote the offshoring, moving U.S. jobs and investment to a lower-wage country. What happened when those kind of investor protections were put into NAFTA that made it suddenly really safe and, in fact, subsidized? You get all that compensation if you relocate to a lower-wage country, in that case, Mexico. Now, Mexico is no longer considered cheap enough. So a lot of the jobs, U.S. jobs, that went to Mexico under NAFTA long ago went to China. China is no longer cheap enough. So now the Chinese state-owned companies are starting to offshore their production to Vietnam. This agreement would give all of those incentives and rights for U.S. firms, while, for instance, the Obama administration is talking about trying to get companies to invest in creating jobs here. At the same time, this agreement would actually promote relocating our investments and our jobs, not just to China, not just to Mexico, but to Vietnam. It's a race to the bottom for the companies looking for places where there are no labor rights. There's no rights for workers to try and organize and represent their own interests. That's the place that the company wants to go. But at the same time, the U.S. firms are constantly fighting against food safety laws here, against financial regulation, who hate Buy America procurement, i.e. buy local, investing our tax dollars back into procuring local food for our schools or American-made goods for our governments to use. Though Buy America is banned in the draft TPP text. So those companies are using the backdoor venue of this misbranded, not really a trade negotiation, to try and basically Trojan horse through a whole set of non-trade policies that are directly against our interests, and by the way, the interests of the majority of people in the other involved countries, which is why, as you said, in different of the TPP countries, there has become real fight back. So in Australia, Philip Morris has used the International Tribunal's ICSID to attack that country's tobacco regulations, their big anti-smoking initiative, health initiative. So in Australia just announced, we will not be submitted in TPP to the foreign tribunals. We will not submit ourselves to that. If you guys want to go over that cliff, knock yourselves out. They have tabled an exception. Or, for instance, Vietnam and Chile and Singapore and Malaysia, those countries have said, we're not going to accept the total ban on financial regulation with respect to capital controls. We need to be able to control if hot money flows into our country. We don't want another global crisis. We won't accept that. Or all of the developing countries have said, we will not accept the U.S. patent proposal. We haven't even talked about this. Heartbreakingly, and here we are, it's the Global AIDS Summit in Washington. The Obama administration yesterday, Secretary Clinton, got a huge protest with TPP signs at her big speech. Why? Because the TPP would expand monopoly patent rights for pharmaceutical companies, undermining life-saving access to medicines in the developing countries where generic drugs are what is used. Imagine the millions of U.S. taxpayer money that goes into PEPFAR, the President's Program for AIDS Medicine in the developing world, that goes to Vietnam. Right now, millions of people can be treated for the amount of money because the drugs are generics. They're not as expensive. If TPP were in effect, Vietnam could no longer use generic medicines. Patents would be extended to this incredibly poor country with a lot of treatable diseases, but the government can only afford generic drugs. They'd have to buy the brand name drugs that make treatment so expensive in the U.S. And there's even provisions being proposed by pharma, pushed by the U.S., again, horribly, that would allow a tax on the national health care systems in countries like New Zealand and Australia, whose medicine formulary systems, though not using all generics, do set prices of reimbursement that will be paid. They have a government board that says, sorry, monopoly drug firm, we're not going to pay that. You want to sell it here, here's the compensation price because we're a national health care system. All of those attacks on access to medicines, on health, are being Trojan horsed through new monopolies in the name of a, quote, free trade agreement.
Lori, we're going to have to end here. Can you give our readers an idea of what, how involved they might be, what they could do? This treaty is a ways off before it's actually signed. Now they're talking about before it's final, the final negotiations being finished next year sometime. So is it a good time for people to get involved, and what should they do?
Now is the time. Go to our website, tradewatch.org. There are a lot of different actions and alerts. There is growing in the U.S. the same kind of fight back that's happened in other countries. The first and foremostest, most important thing to do is to get out the word. We have got to drag this thing in the sunshine. Half of the fight, half of how we stop it, is getting other people aware and making sure our members of Congress are aware. So one of the current actions you'll find on tradewatch.org, as well as a lot more detailed information, is a simple action to call your members of the House, who represent your House member and your two senators, and, you know, ask them, can I have the draft text of the TPP? Because, heck, it's been negotiated for 3 years. You're the U.S. senator. Certainly, well, sir, ma'am, you have it, right? So, Scott Brown, you certainly have it. You're the guy. Send it to me. We want the text. And, of course, that's the moment, because it's been happening in the last 3 weeks, where members of Congress and senators say, oh, my God, why don't I have the text? It's going to do what? So it's pre-written. There's a script there so you can feel comfortable. Or in your own words, it explains how to get hooked up through the Capitol switchboard on Monday. Make yourself a little yellow sticky note and put it in the fridge. Give a call. This kind of an action around the country is the kind of de-Dracula strategizing that we need to do. And then on the website, sign up for your action alerts, because there's a whole global campaign gearing up.
Thank you, Lori Wallach. It's been great to have you join us today.
Thank you very much. And everyone, jump on this. We can avoid it if we work on it.
That was Lori Wallach, Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, speaking with us on the controversial Trans-Pacific Partnership. For Sounds of Dissent, I'm Amy Grunder.